Welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. It's the 16th of December, 2020. This podcast is the second one in the series, Reason on Reason. What I'm going to do in this and the next podcast is take a historical perspective on reason and consider certain aspects of the European Enlightenment, or the Age of Reason, in the full expectation that this will enable me to sketch an outline of what reason might be. Now, you'll remember that I wasn't expecting to be able to define reason, that I was taking reason to be one of those terms that eludes definition in the very strict sense. But that I would be able to paint a picture of it that would give us some sense of its scope, its uses, and its powers. I ask you at this point to bear in mind the previous podcast in the series, the introductory podcast on the nature of reason. And particularly to bear in mind the distinction between instrumental reason, formal reason, and communicative reason that I borrowed from Jürgen Habermas. I'm also going to just remind you of why I want to do this podcast. And I'm doing it because I've gone on record and accused fascists of embracing the irrational, of being unreasonable, of rejecting reason and rationality. And I've also tarred the anti-vaxxers, anti-maskers, COVID deniers, climate change deniers with that same brush, and concluded that they do have something in common with naturally occurring fascism, in that there's a kind of rejection of reason going on. But of course, that poses the question, well, what is reason? And once you start delving, you realise it's not as straightforward as you think. So I'm just going to look at the history of the Age of Reason, an historical epoch that took the name reason, that used the term reason, in the hope, and in fact in the expectation, that we can get some kind of elucidation out of it. Now, it is a pretty complex matter. The so-called European Enlightenment was a very multi-dimensional, cultural, political, economic, scientific phenomenon. Furthermore, we are faced with some problems in the philosophy of history. The minute we start talking about the European Enlightenment or the Age of Reason. And there is a problem in history of what's called periodization. I mean, what is it makes this period worthy of a name? A name that seems to imply that it's a kind of an entity, that there's a beginning point and an end point. These periods that historians use to make historical study manageable are ultimately arbitrary, at least very often. Now, I know that in the case of something like the Second World War, we've got the date that war was declared and the date that the amnesty was signed, even though the aftermath of the war rumbled on for a long time. And the run-up to the war, well, okay, you know, did the Second World War start with the Spanish Civil War or the Italian invasion of Abyssinia or the Japanese invasion of parts of China in the 30s, earlier on in the 30s? So even there, where we've got these formal dates, you still find that you can push your beginning date backwards quite reasonably, and forwards in time after the end quite reasonably. So there's a kind of an arbitrariness about this periodisation. So let's just take it that this is pragmatic. In the case of the European Enlightenment, it does depend who you ask. Commonly, historians say that the European Enlightenment began in the second decade maybe of the 18th century and finished about 1780. Other people push the beginnings of the Enlightenment much further back. They push it back to the middle of the 17th century and push it forward to about 1800, the beginning of the 19th century. Again, this underscores the arbitrary nature of periodisation. Nevertheless, something momentous did happen in the 18th century in Europe and in the European colonies, particularly the United States of America, what was to become the United States of America. And what happened was that there was a monumental paradigm shift on many, many layers that affected many, many aspects of culture and of the economy and of politics and religion and all of the arts, including music, architecture, painting, poetry, literature, and so forth. In all of these aspects of the Enlightenment, there is a characteristic confidence, optimism, a sense of possibility flowing through all the layers and aspects of the era. This is not to say that this was an age of a utopia or an age of ethical excellence. It has its dark side, which I'll mention. I'm not taking it that the Enlightenment is somehow ethically neutral or either. We do have to appraise with our modern sensibility all aspects of it. And you will find that, yes, there are dark sides. This was a period in which there was much colonisation by European powers, particularly the British, the French, Portuguese, the Spanish, in the Americas, in Asia, in the Far East, in the Pacific, in Australasia, and so on. Consequently, there was much appropriation of land and resources of indigenous peoples in many parts of the world, much exploitation, genocide, enslavement, and discourses that supported these actions. Not pretty, and we need to say that. And I'm not wanting to give this story, this narrative about the Enlightenment as a kind of a Eurocentric discourse, you know, making all those Eurocentric suppositions that this was, because it was European, somehow superior to every other intellectual development that took place on the planet. And I'll have to say that many of the features of the Enlightenment that we might want to celebrate were also present at various times in other cultures, other epochs and other parts of the world. And I would say India, China, the Muslim world of the, what was for Europe, the Dark Ages, that there were many developments which prefigure sometimes are more sophisticated than certain developments that we now celebrate as purely a matter of the European Enlightenment. But why we need to deal with this is that it did conquer the world, and there is a sense in which we live with its consequences wherever we live on the planet, whether it's in Japan, in India, or China, or even if we live in the middle of the Amazon jungle, the chances are that you are touched by these developments, even if it's only the matter of the way in which the technology that was kick-started by these developments now pervades the entire planet. And in some non-European civilizations, it's possible to adhere to your traditions and hold them dear at the same time as living in the modern world and in the Enlightenment world. The chances are that your systems of jurisprudence, your education system, your economy are all deriving from these developments. Now, you know, this isn't necessarily a recommendation of how great the Enlightenment was. It is, in many instances, a situation that's a colonial legacy, that's, you know, like the Indian judicial system was inherited from the British because the British commercially conquered the country and then actually politically took it over when it became a part of the empire. So again, I'm not trying to paint a rosy picture of what's gone on here, but I am saying we live with the consequences. It's part of our global ambience, you might say. This is probably why a lot of contemporary philosophers are interested in appraising, evaluating the Enlightenment. And we very often ask of a philosopher, are they a product of the Enlightenment, or are they a product of a reaction against the Enlightenment? And I think you do find in many cases, if you study closely, that both of these things obtain. Certainly, I've done a close study of Nietzsche's view of the Enlightenment, and I find that he's not its champion, but he doesn't reject it wholly either. He takes a critical look at it. And of course, there's a question, is Marxism an offshoot of the Enlightenment or not? So there's, I'll just say, amongst philosophers, not only political philosophers, there is a deep concern for this period, and I expect that it's something that will continue to be a concern for some time. Note also that there were local variations in this Age of Reason, or this Enlightenment. There was a German Enlightenment, French Enlightenment, Scottish Enlightenment, English Enlightenment. There was an Enlightenment of the colonies in the what was to become the United States. Okay, enough caveats and provisos and qualifications. What did it consist in, this paradigm shift that we know as the Age of Reason or the European Enlightenment? The thing that jumps out for our purposes is the rise of science, particularly experimental science, and its practical application, which was to give rise to the Industrial Revolution, which was getting its beginnings in this period, and then accelerated greatly in the following century. The United Kingdom was in the vanguard of these developments, and for particular political and cultural reasons, probably because the bourgeoisie had consolidated its position rather more solidly in the United Kingdom than it had in France and the mishmash of states, which was Germany. Marxist historians like to make a lot of this aspect of the Enlightenment, that it was, in terms of class, that it was a rise of the bourgeoisie. In the UK, you'd had the 1688 revolution, which the monarch was replaced by a monarch who was quite willing just to be a figurehead, rather like a modern British monarch. And that Parliament had really got all the power. And that alongside that, there was perhaps more individual liberty to experiment with economic forms and with a kind of freedom of thought as well. And bearing in mind that the Catholic Inquisition had no reach in the United Kingdom because it was a formerly Protestant country, with the monarch also being the head of the established Anglican Protestant church. So you can look into this in a lot of detail if you want to, and there is something in it. But for whatever reason, Britain was the place where this thing got a march on. I mean, there are also geographical factors like the availability of coal, the availability of timber to make charcoal, the availability of iron ore and limestone for metal smelting, and so forth. I'd tie that in with the rise of naval power based on a long tradition of seafaring, and that in turn arising out of geography, out of the fact that Britain is an island. So we could get carried away here with causal threads, and there are many. On a discursive level, what we've got is a series of developments in formal reason, which find application in instrumental reason, and a kind of an entanglement of these two approaches. Tracing the genealogy of these developments here does take us way beyond our periodisation. I would certainly want to draw attention to the work of Thomas Aquinas, St. Thomas Aquinas, in the 13th century, in which, crucially, Aquinas attempted to rationally support the Catholic faith, the Christian Catholic faith, through the application of reason, through arguments for the existence of God, and so forth. Aquinas himself used resources that he derived from Aristotle. So your periodisation just goes completely out the window, because we're kind of way back in Athens some centuries BC. And this move on Aquinas' part established Aristotle as the philosopher, as a kind of a virtuous Christian who existed before Christianity and before Christ himself. But Aristotle gained an enormous amount of credibility and kudos within the Catholic Church, to the extent that you weren't allowed to contradict him, and you did contradict him at your peril. The Church was, for a long time, quite adept at silencing people who had different views from its official theology and its official dogma. At about the same time, it's interesting that there was a Friar Bacon, Roger Bacon, was actually doing experiments in Oxford, and just taking an experimental mode, even though he was a very ahead of his time in this. I believe Friar Bacon independently discovered gunpowder, even though the Chinese had developed gunpowder considerably before this independent work of Friar Bacon. Subsequent to Aquinas, there was quite a lot of work went on in logic, in refining logic. This would be purely formal reason. People like Nicholas de Cusa, Ockham, Duns Scotus, and so on. The crucial point here, though, that I'm trying to draw out is that reason was taken seriously, that religion was no longer a matter of faith, but also it needed the light of reason to uphold it, to prove it, to strengthen it, and so forth. So this is what happened there. Of course, the other thing is the reference to Aristotle, which gave rise to Aristotle's authority within the Church. And of course, bearing in mind that the Catholic Church just had immense power over Europe and all aspects of life in Europe. Now I'm going to jump forward to the 16th century. Early on in the 16th century, Copernicus, who was a canon of the Church in Poland, developed a heliocentric view of the universe, the solar system, in contra contradiction to the Church's official doctrine that the Earth is at the centre of the solar system, Copernicus discerned that actually the Sun was at the centre and the Earth went round the Sun, not the Sun round the Earth. He did kind of keep this under his hat. I think it would have got him in a lot of trouble if he'd have been banging the drum for his ideas. Right at the end of the 16th century, Francis Bacon was publishing his work on experimental science, on the notion that experimentation is the way to go to increase knowledge of nature. We wish to understand nature, we have to interrogate it through experiment. And to form generalisations or theories or laws or hypotheses from the result of direct observation. And this was a pretty crucial turn. I suppose in a sense Copernicus had already made that turn because he was applying data of astronomical observations to test out his ideas. Right at the beginning of the 17th century, Johannes Kepler, using observations that had been gathered by Tycho Brahe in the previous century, came up with the three laws of planetary motion, which also are in accord with Copernicus's heliocentric view, and which are actually very elegant. Now, I'm going to say this here about Kepler, and it's kind of important, I think, even though it's hardly ever mentioned. Kepler was an astrologer. In fact, he was the court astrologer in Prague to some royalty. And he spent his time seeking out the best observations that he could find of planetary motion. And Tycho Brahe's were the best. He had the best telescopes and measuring equipment in order to cast better horoscopes. And in the published work of Kepler, the three laws actually occur in the footnotes. The works aren't aimed directly at the laws. The laws are almost an accidental byproduct of an astrological project and a Neoplatonic project. I mean, Kepler tried to prove that if the planets emitted a note that was somehow proportional to their distance from the sun, that you would, what's called the harmony of the spheres, that you'd have a perfect musical harmony. It's very Pythagorean, actually, that the universe is structured on the harmony of music. And he did all the calculations to try and prove that and found it didn't quite work. It nearly did, but not quite. After that, he tried to insert the five Platonic solids inside the orbits of the known five known planets. A cube, icosahedron, and so forth, tetrahedron. And of course, that didn't work either. And in fact, as elegant and beautiful as that would be, and the actual laws of motion, planetary motion that Kepler came up with, consigned to footnotes, were nevertheless far more elegant, mathematically very beautiful. In 1616, the Catholic Church officially declared that Copernicus's heliocentric theory was false and erroneous. So if you contradicted the Church, who were taking Aristotle's view as gospel, that the sun was at the centre, you could get yourself into trouble. In subsequent decades, Galileo in Italy was actually working on experimental physics, working out regularities through measurement and experiment in the way that falling bodies behave, and pendulums and so forth. He also had a telescope, and he didn't invent the telescope, but he improved the telescope and was shilling for the heliocentric view. And discovering the moons of Jupiter. By 1633, he was in trouble with the Church, and he was summoned before the Inquisition. And apparently, he was taken into the cellar at the Vatican and shown the torture implements. and forced to recant, which he did do, though rather begrudgingly. And he was placed under house arrest, I think, for the rest of his life as a result of contradicting the philosopher and contradicting church doctrine, even though he had persuaded some grandees of the church to look through the telescope at the moons of Jupiter, only to be told that what was being observed were specks on the lens or some dust inside the tube of the telescope. Bear in mind that it was only about 30 years previously, in, I don't know, 1600, that Giordano Bruno was burned at the stake for promoting the heliocentric model of the solar system. What jumps out at us at this point is that you see a conflict, an epistemological conflict, between the notion that authority is what gives us the truth, scripture is what gives us the truth, the authority of Aristotle is what gives us the truth, over and against what we can observe, and how this epistemological conflict, it's kind of abstract, is also embroiled with power, with secular power, with power over society, with power over the way people think. This is what we need to draw out of that long arc from Aquinas to Galileo. Now, we're still quite away from starting to treat the 18th century, but I do think it's worth tracing these threads of thought through the ages, and to contextualise them in the power politics of the age, and maybe some of the material substrate that's going on in particular times. So before we get to the 18th century, I'm going to have to mention René Descartes, who's a very key player in this story, before we get on to Isaac Newton. And of course, if we're going to mention Newton, we need to mention John Locke as well. But Newton certainly, it was a very, very much a linchpin for that technical, scientific, industrial development of the Enlightenment. The case of René Descartes then. It was only 4 years after Galileo had been threatened by the Inquisition that Descartes published his Discourse on Method in 1637, and then in 1641 he published Meditations on First Philosophy. Descartes was very alert to the power politics, and very alert to the way Galileo had been threatened by the Inquisition, threatened with torture and possibly with death, and actually placed under house arrest. So if you want to contextualise what Descartes was up to, I think bearing that in mind's a good idea. And in fact, we know that this is what he was thinking if we look at the title and the dedication at the beginning of Meditations. I'll let the very first part of Meditations speak for itself. The title, actually, of Meditations is Meditations on the First Philosophy, in which the existence of God and the real distinction of mind and body are demonstrated. And then there's the dedication. I'll read it. To the very sage and illustrious, the dean and doctors of the sacred faculty of theology of Paris. So the Meditations is actually an address to authorities of the church, intellectual authorities of the church, Descartes trying to engage them in dialogue. It's right to question why he does this. And if we read a little bit further on, just the first sentence or two, we can see what's going on here in this respect. I shall read it. Gentlemen, the motive which impels me to present this treatise to you is so reasonable, and when you shall learn its design, I am confident that you will also consider that there is ground so valid for your taking it under your protection, that I can in no way better recommend to you than by briefly stating the end which I proposed to myself in it. Notice he's asking the good Jesuit doctors to protect him from a fate like Galileo's, one would assume, and also to protect the line of reasoning that he's wanting to offer to the public. Now, why is he wanting to offer his line of reasoning? His elucidation of the nature of the body and the soul and his proofs of the existence of God. Why? To get some purchase on this puzzle, we need to just go back a little and consult the Discourse on Method. There's a couple of things we need to draw out from the Discourse on Method. And one is that Descartes was very, very impressed by the certainty of mathematical proofs. And the other is that he did foresee the possibilities of mathematical physics for improving the lot of human beings in a very practical sense. He actually talks about the possibilities of mathematical physics giving us some kind of lordship over nature through the abilities that mathematical physics gives us to predict, as Galileo had clearly demonstrated. Now, the role of the later meditations in this project of making mathematical physics safe in the milieu of the Inquisition, so that human beings can benefit from its practical application, was that Descartes gave us a concept of a body, a physical body, what he called res extensa, a body that's extended in space, and we can mathematise, therefore, because of its simplicity. And this is what he gave mathematical physics, the notion of a point in three-dimensional space and time with no animating properties, no spirit, no guiding angels or animating indwelling spirits. Just a simple body that can be mathematically described. And this is a part of the outcome of the meditations. There are other things going on in the meditations, and it would take us a little bit far afield to describe them here. But I will mention that the meditations relies on a proof or some proofs, so-called, of the existence of God in order to make the whole structure of thought cohere. So in that sense, it's accorded with church doctrine. And therefore, didn't invite, on those grounds, on purely theological grounds, the antagonism of the Jesuits and the Inquisition and the Church. Descartes built on these reasonings by actually developing the mathematics that would do this job of mathematically describing bodies, physical bodies, perhaps by giving us their properties and giving a quantity to their properties, like the length, the breadth, the depth, the weight, so on, but also enabling us to numerically describe their position in space and time. This actually was very useful for the project of ballistics, and I believe that Descartes did make some developments in ballistic using this mathematics that he developed. And he had, as a part of his sort of adventurous career, being a military man. What Descartes developed was known as Cartesian geometry, or analytical geometry. And this enables positions in space to be numerically described, and for trajectories in space, and indeed geometric shapes like circles, ellipses, parabolas, and so on, to be described by algebraic formula. And this whole mathematics makes prediction of the movements, the dynamics of physical bodies, very amenable to calculation and therefore to prediction. So this was a big development. And it was a development that was taken up a little later on by Isaac Newton. As I've already mentioned, Isaac Newton was a pivotal figure, and he laid one of the foundation stones for the European Enlightenment. You can get a sense of the importance of Isaac Newton when you remember that Einstein described Newton as somebody who had been privileged to make the most fundamental intellectual development in the entire history of the human race. Newton brought together the mathematical developments of Descartes, the experimental thrust of Galileo, and Francis Bacon, with a mathematical ability of the very highest order, and an understanding of Kepler's laws of planetary motion, and was able to bring about great leaps forward in dynamics, laws of motion, and optics, the behaviour of light. Newton also developed the calculus, the differential calculus, using Descartes' analytical geometry. It is a development that was also made by Leibniz in Germany, and there was a long dispute between Leibniz and Newton on who was to have a priority, you know, who's to be deemed the developer of calculus. The calculus that we use today is actually the variant, or the notation that Leibniz put together. I mean, Leibniz is altogether a fascinating figure as well, and a genius also. We should note that Newton was, as well as being the great mathematician, physicist, experimenter, natural philosopher, was also an alchemist and a hermeticist, and somebody who spent a great deal of effort and time working through the Bible to figure out the age of the earth, and to look for interpolations that erroneously promote the doctrine of Trinitarianism, and so forth. He was a man with his foot in the future and the past. Newton also was sort of late in life a president of the Royal Society, which was an important institution in the English Enlightenment. And again, in the latter part of his life, the warden of the mint, and he had a great deal of interest in counterfeiting, and was the scourge of counterfeiters in England, and had many of them dispatched to the gallows. So an absolutely fascinating figure, pivotal, but I'm not offering a great man theory of history here. Newton himself said, well, I've seen further than others, maybe, but it's because I stood on the shoulders of giants. Newton was also aware of how much there was to be discovered, and he noted that he felt like a child on the beach, just wandering along and occasionally picking up a pebble, this one or that one, and just looking at it and admiring it, whilst, as in Newton's words, the great ocean of truth lies undiscovered before me. So the groundwork is done, and Newton dies early in the 18th century, and his legacy, a legacy of course that's plugged into centuries of intellectual development, as well as setbacks, and in the context of this dynamic of the rise of the bourgeoisie and the struggle to build some secular power in the midst of the power of religion. And as I just mentioned, Newton himself was religious, though in an unconventional sense. He thought of his activity of scientific discovery as being uncovering the thoughts of God himself. And Newton was a kind of deist, and this was a type of Christianity that grew up in the Enlightenment. A deist basically believes that that God creates the universe at the beginning of time, sets up the laws for its operation, and then retires. This is a notion of God not really intervening historically, you know, with miracles every 2 weeks. Newton did think there were some interventions because he was aware that there were anomalies and irregularities, small ones, that would require God to reset the clockwork of the universe from time to time. This is the notion of God, the clockmaker, building a mechanistic universe that would then unfold and function according to mechanical laws. Of course, this is Descartes' cosmology. So, thanks for listening, and I'm going to try and get the next part of this out within a day or two. I didn't expect this episode on the Enlightenment really to take so much time. It's, as it's transpired, it needs two episodes rather than one. And what I've done in this one, just to recapitulate, is show some of the antecedents to what is generally understood as the European Enlightenment or the Age of Reason, particularly in its scientific aspect. So, once again, thanks for listening. Thanks to patrons for helping this little effort to continue. And make knowledge great again. Take care. Lots of love. Over and out.